ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour. Matt Stevens in again for you today, and it is a pleasure to be with you. I don't want to harp on about the weather, but the storms and wind kicked up yesterday with the front that came through. How did you go yesterday? 1300 1062 22. That number's a bit different to what you would normally call, so keep that in mind. Or you can text 0467 922 783. On Breakfast with Emma Pedler in Port Lincoln this morning, you heard that in 109 years of data, the average rainfall for the area is 24.8 millimetres in November, and already 38 has fallen. We'll check in with the Bureau a little bit later in the show about the next couple of days, which look to be more calm, but it'd be good to know what happened where you are. 1300 1062 22, texting 0467 922 783. Today on The Country Hour, you heard in the news, Riverland Wine has written to the Premier saying that the industry is in crisis and needs help immediately. You'll hear more on that. And rare earth exploration in the Mallee of South Australia is going to continue next year.
Oh, there's most definitely rare earth elements in the area. We'd be looking at more concentrations of between 700 and 1,000 parts per million is something that's more significant, but we did get three that were between 400 and 550, so that's certainly very encouraging. So we'll infill around those areas in the western half of our Cadalia tenement to see if we can get some higher numbers or if there's more continuity of those numbers across the tenement.
Yeah, you'll hear what they're looking for and where they're looking soon.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Crop yields estimates have gotten a boost following rainfall during October in parts of the state. According to the latest update to the Crop and Pasture Report for 2025-26, which was released by PIRZA, grain production estimates have been boosted to 8.8 million tonnes, which is back to being on par with South Australia's five-year average. PIRZA's General Manager of Industry, Partnership and Intelligence, Matthew Palmer, explained where in the state the forecast numbers have changed.
Some parts of the state will see an average to above average crop. So in southern parts of the state and in central regions, whereas parts of the Mallee are still well below average in terms of rainfall. And some of those regions are really still doing it tough, and we'll see a well below average crop in the Mallee and in the northern parts of the state. No real change in crop area estimates, apart from some of our crops getting cut for hay. So our hay estimate has also increased significantly and will be the largest hay crop in probably the last 5 years, at around 1.2 million tonnes cut for hay, with hay prices, strong demand from livestock producers for hay. A number of crops are being cut for hay, so we'll see a higher proportion of our crop cut for hay. There's some other changes in crop mix over the last few years, which we're continuing to see this year. So there's a significant uptake in lentil production across many parts of the state. And so that's seen a big increase over the last 5 years, and particularly the last 2 or 3 years in lentil production.
Any changes with the pest pressures with this added rain? Anything farmers need to be keeping an eye on?
So most of the pest and disease pressure has been manageable. I'm seeing a few reports across Northern Adelaide and across the York Peninsula around mice pressure, which is a potential concern for going into the next season. So that will be hopefully won't impact this year's crop, but something just need to be that farmers will need to be conscious of as we move into seeding next year.
General Manager at PIRZA, Matthew Palmer. For many farmers, even just a return to an average season will be a welcome result. Grain Producers SA CEO Brad Perry says the rains have been a relief for many farmers.
Rains through October certainly helped finish off some crops in some of the regions that needed it. So I think that's been a welcome boost. But I think it's still a bit of a wait and see on cereal hay. There's been a lot of a lot of cereal cut for hay, and then there's also been quite a bit of rain through this month as well that's been scattered. So it's a bit of a wait and see on the hay front, but look, if we can get out of this season with something that's close to average, I think that's a remarkable effort.
And what about the differences between the regions in the state? I'm assuming very different results are expected.
Yeah, it's quite stark actually between some areas. So if you look up on, you know, the York Peninsula, parts of the York Peninsula, southeast and Eyre Peninsula, you know, there's some really good looking crops. But you go down towards the Riverland, Mallee, and some of those more marginal areas where there just hasn't been enough rain, and you know, there's not even enough crop to feed livestock. So certainly the drought hasn't broken yet, and there's a number of regions that are still feeling the impacts of that this season and will for some time. But it, like it has been over the last few years, it's been quite a mixed bag. But to get an overall average, you know, I think we'll be pretty happy if we can reach that as a state. I'm looking forward to seeing how lentils go this year. So we've had an increase in plantings of lentils once again right across the state, as we did last year. And I think it's been another challenging year, obviously being dry for much of it without a starting rain and for many regions without a finishing rain. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the lentil quality is like and what it yields. And I think that's going to go a long way to decision-making for next year.
And just with hay production, Brad, I know here where I am in the southeast, farmers will be able to get enough hay, but generally not the quality they were hoping for with the rain. Is that going to be the case in other patches as well?
Yeah, it has been a bit of a hindrance, really, for those that took the risk and cut some cereal for hay. You know, I don't think they expected it to rain so much. So some of that quality certainly would have been impacted. And that's right across the state. So, again, that's a bit of a wait and see as to the full impact on that. But I think that overall, obviously, those rains are frustrating for those that have started harvest. It's been a bit of a stop-start harvest. But hopefully we can store some of that in the soil and finally get, after 2-3 years, we can finally get a seeding, hopefully, that's a little bit more moisture-driven rather than straight into dry.
A lot of farmers, as you said, will be relieved that there's been that rain and maybe a bit of a return to an average year, but an average year that won't allow many to financially recover from the last few years.
Oh, not at all. I mean, we're still working through, you know, the impacts of the last couple of years of drought. So I think that's going to have flow-on effects for a number of years, particularly financially. So we are going to see, we're hoping we return to, you know, average rainfall and average crops and we can actually break the back of the drought. That's the ultimate, but certainly it's going to take many years once we reach for the recovery stage from the drought in a lot of the regions. It's going to take a long time for some businesses to restructure and they'll be feeling the financial impacts of that for years.
And when we are talking numbers, sometimes it can be a bit easy to forget about the individual farmers. Brad, have you had talks with many people? How are they doing going with harvest so far this year and how have they generally been feeling?
Yeah, it really depends on which region they're in. So, you know, I've spoken to farmers who, you know, it's been quite heartbreaking. They just haven't had the rain to get crops up. Others have, you know, have got enough crop to put some stock on. And then there's other farmers who have really snagged, you know, some excellent rainfall and ended up with crops that look quite good. So I think from a well-being point of view and an attitude point of view, there's certainly mixed emotions right across the state. What we're really hoping we can do is return to some normality and also ensure that those good farmers who just haven't been able to get crops due to rain, lack of rain for the last couple of years, that we can get them through and back to good production, good financial and health.
Grain Producers SA Chief Executive Officer Brad Perry talking to Elsie Adamo. I know it's the nature of farming, but just the disparity across the state at the moment for the different levels of rainfall, different performance of crops at the moment, it really is astounding to see the differences that are involved there. I know some are getting harvesters out at the moment and getting in to get what they can, and hopefully there'll be some ability to recover there. So, yeah, definitely fingers crossed for upcoming harvest if you haven't started yet as well. It is 12:15.
Here we go.
Coming to the ABC, new drama, Goolagong.
She's a natural.
Brand new dog park.
I'm happy with that handshake.
And so much more.
That's 2026.
Just you wait. On ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour for a Tuesday. A joint open letter has been sent to Premier Peter Malinauskas from the Riverland wine industry to arrange a crisis meeting for the industry. The letter says the risk of inaction for helping the wine industry is now catastrophic and the Riverland is breaking. It goes on to say that wine grape prices have fallen to historic low levels over the last 5 years, with Shiraz the worst hit, and prices for white grapes are also declining, and early indications for this year's vintage are lower than last year's pricing. That's really interesting that white grapes are having an issue as well. There is a lengthy paragraph on the cost of water as well as production input costs, which growers say is now at more than $350 a tonne. I'll read what the letter is asking for. It says, we are calling for, one, a government-led crisis meeting with industry, banks, peak bodies and representatives of growers and wineries within the region by the end of January. Two, an immediate and structured support package for those who want to adapt and continue to farm. Three, transitional support for those exiting the industry to address vineyard abandonment, biosecurity threats and long-term land devaluation. And four, investment in a regionally specific export market package focused on commercial, popular, bottled and unpackaged wines to increase global market presence and reduce oversupply. We've been in contact with the signatories for that letter today, but unfortunately they aren't available to speak. And there's also a call into the Premier's office for his response to what the industry is saying. We've received a response from a government spokesperson, and I'll read that in part for you as well. It's quite lengthy. It says, the Riverland wine industry's request has been received and is under active consideration. The oversupply of wine grapes and large bulk wine inventories held by producers are driving the issues affecting the Riverland and other wine regions in Australia and overseas. Since Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven established a National Viticulture and Wine Sector Working Group to provide advice on how to move the wine sector to a sustainable supply-demand balance, the Commonwealth and state governments have established multiple programs totaling more than $15 million to address these issues. And the statement goes on to list the programs there as well. What do you think? 1300 106222, or you can text as well, 0467 922 783. If you'd like to read the letter for yourself, you can find it on the news section of the Riverland Wine website. There's a mention too that if the wine industry in the Riverland was to collapse, there would be significant effects on communities and their viability into the future as well. If you'd like to talk about this, I'd love to hear from you. 1300 106222, or you can text 0467 922 783.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Thanks very much for the text coming through this afternoon. Kim at Lindsay Point. Hi, Matt. Doing a good job on The Country Hour. Thank you. We had 9.5 to 13 mil out here, and we've lost around 75 odd trees from 2 year old to 25 year old trees. Wow. Was that from the wind yesterday, Kim? Amazing. Got to love Mother Nature. And Brian on the text as well says, Mallee drought, what is PIRZA doing to collate hay for Mallee sheep producers? Not sure, Brian. We have spoken about that before, but we will follow up once again. It is 19 past 12. Yesterday, you heard that there have been explorations in the southern Mallee looking for rare earth minerals. The mayor of the district council, Ron Valentine, was aware of the explorations happening, but there weren't many details on how it was progressing or what the future held. We've been in contact with Cali Resources, who are performing the explorations. They had been testing along public roadsides in September within their tenements to the north and west of Lamaru and Pinneroo. Mark Derriman is principal consultant with Cali Resources Limited, and he says that they have been encouraged by their initial testing.
Yeah, this is the initial exploration process to determine proof of concept to see if there is any significant rare earth mineralisation developed within the clays within our tenements. Our first exploration program, which we just finished, was a very wide-spaced drilling program, 1,000 metres between holes, just to see if there was any mineralisation within the road verges, but not necessarily inside properties as yet.
Does that mean there are rare earth elements in the area?
Oh, there's most definitely rare earth elements in the area. We'd be looking at more concentrations of between 700 and 1,000 parts per million is something that's more significant. But we did get three that were between 400 and 550. So that's certainly very encouraging. So we'll infill around those areas in the western half of our Cadalia tenement to see if we can get some higher numbers or if there's more continuity of those numbers across the tenement.
For people who don't know kind of how it all works, and you mentioned, you know, total earth oxide, can you sort of put that into layman's terms for us?
All right. The rare earth minerals are a row of minerals at the bottom of the periodic table. There's about 14 of them. We then do our drilling and we send the samples into a laboratory in Adelaide and they come back with the elements. So that'll give us a parts per million value for lanthanum, yttrium, praseodymium, the 14 rare earth elements. Each of those rare earth elements are then converted to oxides. There's a number between about 1.1 and 2 that is multiplied with the element values from the lab. That gives us our oxide value for the elements. We then add those 14 oxide values together, and that gives us our total rare earth oxide number, and that'll be in our ASX announcement that's been released to the market.
And I've heard, Mark, that the Murray-Darling Basin whole sort of area is quite rich in minerals. Is this because of the lay of the land and how it sort of all worked back in the day?
Look, as far as the Murray Basin goes, I guess the significant asset would be water, and I guess the landowners use that, and they do the same drilling that we do. Our holes have been a maximum of 18 metres, so our drilling is well above where the aquifers are. We're testing the very top surface. The other, I guess, significant mineralisation there would be heavy minerals, and there's several significant heavy minerals, primarily in the western Victorian side of the Murray-Darling Basin. So their operations are ongoing now. Rare earth is quite a different form of mineralisation. It's attached to the clays. So we think that there's certainly potential there, and there's a company called Australian Rare Earths that has a resource in right to the south near border, south of Bordertown. So there's encouragement. As explorers, we like to think that there is more than just one resource in that whole limestone coast Mallee area, and that's why we're exploring.
So you mentioned next steps is to do a bit of drilling closer together. Are there any sort of timelines about when that might happen at this stage?
I guess at this stage we'd be looking at quarter one 2026.
Are you looking at any new areas as part of that as well, or the same areas that you tested before?
The same tenements. We have three tenements, or Carly Resources has three tenements in the Mallee area, and we'll be doing drilling between, closer space drilling between. We've already got anomalous results. So the same method, going along the road with our little caravan of cars and drill rig, et cetera, and infilling between the areas. So the same method, just a few more holes.
And you said that, you know, rare earth elements are a bit different in terms of they're found in that topsoil, and that's sort of what you're looking at the moment. If mining, you know, was to happen, and we're talking obviously a long way down the track here, this is, like you said, just the very start of the process, is it a different extraction process because of that as well?
It would be the same process as used for mineral sands operations in Victoria and probably in South Australia too, whereby there'd be progressive rehabilitation as you go, very shallow open cuts, and as you proceed across the band of mineralisation, the rehabilitation of the land would continue behind. And I guess what we're doing is we're taking a thousand parts out of a million parts. So most of the material that we take out, or the rare earths that we take out, aren't used for the the agricultural side of things. So we're taking a very small part, and what we're returning back into the ground would just be sands and clays that's already there.
So next steps from here, Mark, you said those drilling to happen. Once you had results come back from that, what happens from here?
Carly, as a company, are explorers and not necessarily are miners. There are people that do that phase of things. But from our point of view, we would be looking at doing the next phase of drilling, if we're getting a significant concentration of mineralisation along the road verges, then we would contact the landowners to gain access. And that's obviously a process that involves us going, talking to them and talking compensation, talking access. And that can take a while. And probably also a community presentation at Lamaru or Pinaroo to get those landowners that we might not necessarily be thinking about going on their land at the moment, but in the future, so then we can be asked further questions before we do our drilling on people's properties.
Mark Derriman, Principal Consultant with Cali Resources Limited, talking to Anita Ward there. There will be more testing happening in the new year, so we'll stay on that one for you as well. It's 25 past 12, time to talk weather, and after yesterday, where it went a little bit crazy around the place, it seems to have settled down. Simon is your forecaster at the Weather Bureau this afternoon. Hello, Simon.
G'day there, Matt.
We had a couple of different rainfall reports through, anywhere from, say, 5 to 10 millimetres, depending on where you were across the state, but that all seems to have shifted away now.
Yeah, and generally, the storms that moved across yesterday didn't produce very much rainfall at all, and did start a few fires because of that. I think we saw some fires up around sort of Mount Remarkable area and over the northern part of the Riverland, the very far south of the Northeast Pastoral District there. So a few fires popping up with those. Today, most of that lightning activity has moved further north, but the trough that brought the milder conditions to most parts of the state is moved right up into the far northeast corner. So we're still seeing some very hot conditions in the very far northeast corner. The rest of the state likely to see temperatures quite a bit lower today than those of yesterday. And the winds generally more southerly over the north of the state, but we've seen the winds in the south turn westerly, even west to northwesterly, ahead of an approaching front. We can see that front over the western part of the bight on the satellite picture at the moment. And that feature will move across mostly across the southern coastal districts of our state very late this evening or through the early hours of Wednesday morning.
Okay.
Conditions, I think, will be mostly dry across the south today. There could be an isolated light shower in that westerly or western-northwesterly airstream, but I think the best chance of picking up some showers will be through that overnight period as that feature moves across. It'll also bring a bit of wind with it, and as well as the showers, maybe the chance of a very isolated thunderstorm here and there. So we'll probably see the winds pick up a bit, become a little bit gusty, some showers, mostly over the southern agricultural area, and the chance of a rumble of thunder as well. And with those thunderstorms, a slight chance of some gusty winds with them as well. Mm. Those showers are, I think, likely to at least ease, if not mostly clear, by Wednesday afternoon, as that front continues to move away to the east. So I think by afternoon they'll be more isolated, mostly just around southern coasts. And up in the far north, we'll see a continuing area of showers and isolated thunderstorms in the far north as that trough just continues to linger in the very far north there. Later in the week, though, we will see a little bit more weather on the way. A more vigorous trough moving across from the west on Friday. We'll see showers and thunderstorms extend across most districts, I think, and even the risk of some severe thunderstorms over the northern part of the state as well, with a risk of wind, hail and locally heavy rainfall.
Wow.
With those storms on Friday. So, yeah, so a little bit more weather on the way on Friday with a bit more of a vigorous front moving across. So that will bring a little bit of interest to most people, I think. But it will clear away pretty quickly. I think any storms and showers associated with that feature will clear to the east through the early hours of Saturday morning. And really, for the following few days, we're mostly dominated by a ridge. There's a little front that moves across the south on Monday, but really we're ridge dominated for a few days after that, which will keep our weather mostly stable. A few showers around here and there, mostly about the southern agricultural area on Sunday and early next week, but much calmer sort of weather compared with the windier, showery day we're likely to see on Friday.
Right. So I'm guessing that with showers and storms involved in Friday's forecast, it's going to be very patchy for rainfall totals around the place?
Yeah, look, I think there were probably be enough showers that most places will see at least something, but the totals will vary a bit with the sort of more localised nature of the showers and the thunderstorms. So I think we'll probably see fairly widespread falls in the range of 2 to 10 millimetres, but places that pick up a heavier shower or maybe more frequent showers or a thunderstorm will see 10 to 20 millimetres, I think. And I think the agricultural area and the far south of the pastoral district is probably a bit more likely to see those slightly higher falls in that 10 to 20 millimetre range. And anywhere that picks up a thunderstorm would be the chance of a bit more as well, you know, possibly 20 to 30 millimetres with thunderstorms. And those areas of higher ground about the Flinders and Mount Lofty ranges and near the southern coasts as well are likely to pick up a little bit more as well, possibly into that 20 to 30 millimetre range. So some reasonable totals possible with that feature moving across on Friday.
All right, so we'll get prepared for that one. Simon, thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Forecast this afternoon at the Weather Bureau in Adelaide. Let's have a look at what's going on in Western New South Wales. For the Upper Western, mostly sunny, slight chance of a shower and the chance of a thunderstorm. Winds northwest to southwesterly, 15 to 20 kilometres an hour, tending southeast to southwesterly, 20 to 30 kilometres an hour in the morning, and then tending west to southwesterly in the middle of the day. Overnight temperatures falling between 19 and 25. That's a bit warm overnight. And daytime temperatures 35 to 41. Feel summer coming there. And for the lower western, mostly sunny, chance for thunderstorm. Winds northwest to southwesterly, 20 to 30 kilometres an hour, tending west to southwesterly in the morning. Overnight temperatures falling to between 14 and 19, with daytime temperatures reaching 29 to 35. 29 to 1.
Rushes in and bowls a yorker and bowls him.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Let's hope the next one's a bit longer than 2 days. Let's catch up with the headlines before we do anything else. Matt Coleman in the newsroom. G'day, Matt.
Hello, Matt. In the news this afternoon, white wine grape prices have plummeted. According to a Riverland-based grower representative, Riverland Wine says it's written an urgent letter to the Premier, Peter Malinauskas, describing the region as experiencing a full-blown community emergency. Riverland Wine says an industry crisis meeting must be held by the end of January and the state government must offer an exit package. The ABC understands convicted child murderer Bevan Spencer von Einem only has a short time to live. Von Einem was transferred from Port Augusta Prison to Yatala Prison yesterday. The 79-year-old is linked to what police dubbed the family murders, the deaths of five young men and boys in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And Robes Mayor says it's disappointing that bad weather has forced a major cruise ship to not let its passengers off at the town. The Silver Nova would have been the largest ship ever to let off passengers at Robe, with about 600 people on board, but strong winds and rough seas mean the passengers won't be disembarking. More news at 1 o'clock.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Matt Stevens with you on The Country Hour for Tuesday, the 25th of November. Get in touch if there's something you'd like to talk about. 1300 1062 22, the number a little bit different to usual. And texting as well, that number's always the same, 0467 922 783. Simon on the text says the Riverland wine industry's panic is perplexing. This issue has been brewing for many years. It's not a surprise to anyone in the industry. Simon, thanks very much for your text. I agree. It has been brewing for many years. The price of grapes has been an issue for a long time. The input costs as well, also an issue within the industry as well. But I think it's reached a crunch point now where the programs and facilities that have been put in place aren't necessarily working, which is why they've asked for the government help and support and the meeting with government as well, but we'll keep on to that and see where it goes. Coming up, the ag industry is working to educate school children about where their food and products come from, but also how they're made.
But I think if we step back and look overall, we're seeing a real disconnect between urban populations and kids knowing and understanding where their food, fibre, forestry and fish come from, but also the important role that our industries have in the Australian economy, but also caring for at least 50% of Australia's land mass and more than half of Australia's waterways, including oceans.
You'll hear how that education program could work before 1 o'clock this afternoon. We learnt over the weekend the new bomb website cost more than $96.5 million. Have you processed that? After all that money spent, the new look site has been smashed by the public. You've had your say. Yeah, the Bureau say they've received more than 350,000 pieces of feedback. The new chief executive of the Bureau of Meteorology, Dr. Stuart Minchin, has been in the job for 2 weeks, and he spoke to Raf Epstein on ABC Melbourne this morning.
I don't think it's just a marketing misbrand. I think there are some genuine issues that people have pointed out on the website, and we've taken that feedback on board. There's no doubt that the change in the look and feel of the website has been something that many people have not liked. But I would highlight that the reason for the change in the look and feel is about accessibility. So the previous website, for example, was completely inaccessible to people with vision impairment that rely on text readers to access the website. So we were missing a whole chunk of the community that needs weather information. So some of the decisions made are deliberate and positive. There are some other things that have been done that have missed the boat, and that's where we're taking that feedback on board and fixing it. A good example is the radar. So moving the from the old colour scheme of the reflectance to the millimetres per hour product, it was always available on the new website, but it defaulted to the new setting rather than the old setting. And that was just a misread of how used people were to accessing that previous information product.
How much does it cost so far?
$96.5 million is the total cost of the website, but that's part of a much bigger program of work, hardening the back end of the entire Bureau system, having a backup supercomputer and a whole range of other investments. So it's about 10% of the total investment in the upgrade of the Bureau systems.
The Bureau was adamant. The ABC were asking questions of the Bureau weeks ago saying it's not 4 million, it's close to 100 million. They had people saying that on tape. They had the tender documents. The Bureau was saying, no, it's not what you just said. Mm. It's not 96 million, it's closer to 4. Mm. If the bomb tried to hide the truth before, why should people believe you now?
Well, look, firstly, I wouldn't say that they were hiding the truth. I was saying they were being quite selective in answering the specific question, which was, what was the design cost of the website? So that was true, $4 million. They did not...
Quite selective. Was that the wrong approach?
Well, I believe so. And that's why when I had the opportunity, I was very clear with the Australian people about the total cost. And that's my approach. I want to be open, honest and transparent with the Australian people, and then explain the reasoning behind all of this so that we can have a trusting relationship.
Clearly some people are still unhappy. Is that going to require more money to adjust?
Well, it's always been in our forward budget that we were planning to make enhancements to the website. So there's not going to need a new investment in the website. It was always part of our plan.
So does that mean there's money in a pot reserved for what you need to do?
Well, we have appropriation that the government gives us every year, and we'll use some of that appropriation to fix the website and to adjust to meet users' expectations. So that was always a website like this that everyone uses across the country, more than 2 million hits per day, is always going to need adjustment and improvement in an ongoing sense. So
any idea how much extra that's going to cost?
It's part of our normal appropriation. I couldn't pull a figure out, but it's we're working hard on addressing this long list of feedback that we've received from the Australian public. We've received 350,000 items of feedback from the Australian public so far. But I should say that that's actually only come from 1% of the users of the website, right? So we're getting a lot of good feedback, constructive feedback from the public, and we're addressing that. But 99% of the users are not actually providing any feedback. And the website is actually more used. The new website is being used more by the public than the previous website was. So
that's, all publicity is good publicity.
No, I wouldn't say that. But look, there's no doubt we haven't got everything right in the new website, but it is something that we're actively working on, and we're treating the feedback that we're getting as genuine feedback and something that we need to work on.
To get really big and broad and important, one of the most significant politicians in the country is David Littleproud. He's the leader of the Nationals. He says the changes have been a danger to businesses and a danger to lives. Is he right?
Well, no, I don't think it's been a danger to lives or to businesses. What I do accept, and from the feedback from David Littleproud, and in fact from much of the farming community, is the current navigation that it defaults to place names and town named places is actually not serving the farming community effectively. So if you're 100 kilometres from the nearest town, you can't currently access the through the navigation in the web page, you can't readily get information about your farm. And that's something that's being worked on in the background. You can through MetEye, which is still linked through the website, you can get that information for your location, but it is difficult to navigate to that. So this is the case with much of the website commentary. A lot of the information is there, but you've got to go a different way to find it. And that's something that is really something we're trying to explain to the users. And some of that's been done deliberately, as I mentioned, for accessibility reasons. Mm-hmm. And some of it is the subject of legitimate feedback to say, actually, we're going to fix this. So one of the updates we're going to do, hopefully later this week, is we're going to have a button on the front page that takes you straight to the radar. So that people don't have to go through a couple of layers of menus to do that. So we are taking this on board. We are adjusting as we go.
Hasn't everyone had a comment on this? Chief Executive of the Bureau of Meteorology, Dr. Stuart Minchin, talking to Raf Epstein earlier this morning. 19:01, this is the Country Hour. A new tool will allow onion growers to do rapid testing to identify fungicides. The new project has been funded by Hort Innovation. It uses a method similar to PCR testing for COVID, interesting, to allow them to better protect their crops from diseases. The project lead, Dr. Benjamin Evatt, explains why this is such an exciting project.
What normally happens on farms is growers don't know they have a disease until symptoms show up. And then sort of by that time, they already have the disease and it's too late. With this sort of new diagnostic test we're developing, we'll be able to detect the presence of disease early, and we'll also be able to look in soil to see sort of how much of it's there before crops are planted. And we're also going to be able to look in other places, so like maybe weeds or other crops, to try to figure out where this disease is coming from, like what its source is.
And this is particularly for onions?
Yep. So we're going to be focusing on three diseases in onions. The main one is Stemphylium, which has sort of been a problem for a while, but is really starting to become a much bigger problem than it previously has been. And there's some pretty concerning research coming out of other countries just showing exactly how devastating this disease can get, and also how quickly it develops resistance to fungicides. So there's some places where they don't actually have any control options for this disease anymore. And we're not sure exactly the state of fungicide resistance here in Australia. So we're going to be looking into that as well and try to figure out what some of our control options are.
That's the key focus of this one, but there's three major pathogens that this will be able to focus on.
So we're also going to develop these diagnostic tests for a disease called powdery mildew. And we've also been looking at another disease called alternaria or purple blotch. It is looking like developing this diagnostic test for that disease might not actually happen. It's a bit trickier, but that's been a focus of this project as well.
And with these pathogens, can you sort of explain a bit more about what their current impact is and what sort of impact they could have if they're not detected?
Yeah, so I know from personal experience in the Lockyer Valley last season, the disease was so devastating that a lot of onion growers didn't actually bother harvesting because their onions were just so damaged and the yields were so low that it was no longer worth it for them. So for them, that's a huge loss to put all this effort into growing a crop and then just have to leave it rot in the field because of a disease. And I know a lot of onion growers in the Lockyer as well decided, because of how devastating the disease was, that they weren't going to plant onions again, which is, yeah, quite unfortunate. And I think this is also becoming a similar problem in lots of other growing regions as well.
Can you tell me a bit about how these tools work?
So what they're called PCR tests, and probably everyone still remembers that term from COVID, when everyone was going and getting PCR tests done for COVID. And basically, they detect the DNA of the pathogen. So it's a molecular test that's designed to detect if the DNA of a disease is present or not. And the reason that's really valuable is because it's super sensitive. Like, even if you just have a really small amount of disease present and the plant isn't actually showing any disease symptoms yet, this kind of test can still pick it up and let you know if it's there or not. And then hopefully farmers can act a bit more proactively and do something before it becomes a problem.
How can growers access these tools?
So we're hoping to have these tools ready for growers to use by next onion season. And the actual methods for doing this PCR test are going to be published online. So any diagnostic lab, private or government, or research will be able to then basically offer this test themselves if they want. So hopefully it'll be available through lots of different labs and diagnostic places.
Dr. Benjamin Evatt there from Metagen Australia talking to Eliza Burlard. Interesting, isn't it? Have a project like that in PCR testing. Thought we'd heard the last of that after COVID. It is 14 to 1. Thank you. Tex, one here says, Riverland Wines press release is an attempt by wineries to further drive down grape prices. Thank you. I don't exactly understand why you've said that, but I thank you for the text nonetheless. And Big Tony's on the header this afternoon, says, I was flabbergasted when I heard the bomb upgrade cost $4 million, $96 million WTF. I think we all said the same thing, Tony.
You're listening to The Country Hour.
You know how the ag industry works. You know what goes into growing different elements of the food that is delivered. Unfortunately, that knowledge reduces the closer you get to the city, to the point of getting to schools, and there is very little knowledge of the process. The National Schools Food and Fibre Education Strategy has been launched to make a difference by educating children on where, but also how, the food and products they use are made. Troy Setter is the chair of the Council of Rural Research and Development Corporations. Troy, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thank you for having me. Great to be on talking about this important topic.
Yeah, why is this strategy needed?
Look, I think there's some, it's fair to say, some great work being done by some excellent teachers on connecting food, fibre, and forestry and fish to students. But I think if we step back and look overall, we're seeing a real disconnect between urban populations and kids knowing and understanding where their food, fibre, forestry and fish come from, but also the important role that our industries have in the Australian economy, but also caring for at least 50% of Australia's land mass and more than half of Australia's waterways, including oceans. So it's really about building connections and making sure that people have a good understanding as they grow and develop about where their food, fibre, forestry and fish come from.
We've spoken about this before, about that disconnect between city and country, and I would have thought most people would be pretty good but with it. But what is planning to be taught in schools for this?
We're planning to teach probably more than just where does your food come from, so that more than the simplistically milk comes from a cow or bread comes from wheat, the role that farmers and processors, the supply chain has in caring for land and caring for country, rural and regional jobs, But as well as the exciting jobs that are available going forward, food and agriculture is certainly a growth industry globally and a growth industry particularly for Australia. A lot of technology used in agriculture now, and a lot of innovation. And as we look at tightness in the jobs market for people in agriculture, some areas find it really hard, but also the changes that are going to happen with AI and modernisation in other industries, we also want to showcase and highlight that that agriculture and food production, fibre and forestry are great places for people to have a career.
Troy Setter is Chair of Council of Rural Research and Development Corporations with a education strategy that they're putting forward. How do you plan for it to be rolled out?
There's already 15,000 references to food and fibre in the Australian curriculum, so it's there. What we're planning on rolling out from the feedback we've had from schools and from teachers is that they're struggling to connect that to real examples and pull it together and have the right stories around how forestry, fishing and farming actually works. So we want to make sure there's actual, you have simple case studies that teachers can use. We're also planning on continuing just to engage direct with teachers. PIEFA is an organisation that represents the agricultural teachers across Australia, and they've been really crucial in this and important. And so making sure they've got the right resources for teachers that are interested in agriculture. I think too, there's the 15 rural and research development corporations have a huge connection with the tens of thousands of farmers across Australia, and we do get them from time to time coming to us saying, hey, how can I help my local school? How can I give them information or the right tools? So there'll also be some direct engagement with farmers so that and their industry so that they're actually got material that they can share within their local communities as well or you know through friends and family.
Troy, you quite often on farms you'll find that it's a family succession plan handed down from one person to the next through the generations. Are you hoping that it'll make a difference there? Because sometimes the younger generations don't necessarily want to take on the farm. Could there be a help in here from what you're planning to educate people on?
Yeah, I think definitely it can help as well. I think it can help those younger people who may be in the more of the traditional family farm and with succession and family farms having to be divided or worked out through the family, that there is opportunities to stay in agriculture, have a connection to the family farm, but some of your income might be in another part of the industry or post-farm gate, that there's career opportunities there. We're certainly seeing that family farm succession is ongoing and other opportunities for careers in agriculture to allow the succession to occur, I think will be important.
Troy Setter, thanks so much for joining the Country Hour. Troy is the Chair of the Council of Rural Research and Development Corporations. Lee, thank you. Good luck teaching kids about food. What's the parents doing? Real meat or fake meat? Milk? Cow, almond, soy labelling. Yeah, I know, it gets confusing, doesn't it? Thank you, Lee. And Brian says, farm education, YouTube Jackson Brothers. Family farming, Maury, very good education of producing grain. I've found that there's a lot on social media that do really well. I mean, say what you want about your TikToks and your things, but there's a lot of interesting information there that shows it in a really fun way. But thanks for that, Brian. I'll go look them up.
During an emergency,
power's not on, the line's still down, the tree's still on it.
Find your local ABC radio station.
Who's without power or phone, but hopefully listening to the ABC on a battery radio.
ABC Radio is your emergency broadcaster.
6 to 1, Country Hour, 1,095 days. That's about how long it takes to turn barley into a bottle of whiskey. But one Victorian farmer is transforming two more unconventional crops, red wheat and sugar beet, into spirits you might not expect. Faith Tabulam has this story.
So we spring sow our barley here, but after the recent rain, it's definitely helping it out quite a lot.
Ross Shaw is pretty comfortable talking crops.
That's because he's a sixth-generation farmer and agronomist from Victoria's Gippsland region.
We're like a traditional sort of mixed farming operation. We run Aussie white sheep and we have cattle and we do hay and cropping as well.
But 2 years ago, Mr. Shaw decided to go against the grain.
Yeah, returning to the farm, I wanted to be able to value add to our sort of commodities and have a little bit of extra income off farm. So I've opened a distillery. In Gippsland, most grain just goes for feed. There's not really a receival for malt or flour grades or anything like that. Yeah.
And we're standing here in the distillery, Ross. So can you describe what we're looking at?
So we've got the 1,200 litre pot still in the corner, and it's just going through a wash run at the moment, doing the first stage in making a single malt whiskey, basically. So that'll run for most of the day, and we collect the low wines, and then once we've collected enough, it'll go back again for a second distillation and make pot distilled single malt.
And so you've been distilling for about 2 years now?
Yeah, so for about 2 years we've been filling barrels with whiskey, mostly single malt, some wheat whiskey, a few other little experimental lines. Yeah, and we've just recently brought out a couple of clear spirits. So we did a wheat vodka, red wheat vodka, and a sugar beet spirit.
You heard that right. A sugar beet spirit and red wheat vodka. This year, the distillery pumped out about 400 bottles of both spirits. So where did the idea for them come from? I'll let Mr. Shaw explain.
Unlike whiskey, the clear spirits, you can get them to market a lot quicker. They don't have to sit in a barrel or age or anything. So we had the red wheat and we thought, let's see how this goes with the vodka. Did a few trials and landed on a recipe that we like. And it's quite a nice vodka. It's got a little bit of like a honeycomb sweetness, a little bit of graininess, and it comes across quite well. And then the sugar beet spirit, the local town of Maffra was founded on sugar beets. So we thought surely we could make alcohol out of this. Anything with sugar or a starch source, you can ferment and make alcohol. So we took that historic crop. It was hard to find seed. We had to import some seed from Europe, grew the beets, and took quite a while to figure out how to process these beets and get the sugar out of them. But we've sort of landed on a bit of a process that works quite well now, and making the sugar beet spirit.
Now, those recipes will remain a secret, but when it comes to whiskey, Mr. Shaw says the distilling process starts with an old dairy vat.
Yeah, so this is an old 3,000 litre stainless steel dairy vat. We crush our grain into here, so we'll crush about 600 kilos of barley if we're doing a single malt, and then about 2,000 litres of water, and you've got to hold it at about 65 degrees for an hour, basically, and the natural enzymes inside the barley turn the starch into sugar so that you have a fermentable sugar source for the yeast to eat and make the alcohol. So after it leaves the vat, it goes through a separator that separates the grain and all the husk away from our sugary water or sugary wash, and then that goes into the fermenter, and you pitch the yeast when it's at the correct temperature, and that'll ferment for sort of a week, sometimes 2 weeks. And once that's finished, it goes into the still for the next part of the process.
Right. And all up, including it staying in the barrels, takes about 2 years at least.
Yeah, 2 years is the minimum aging time for whiskey in Australia. But we have, the way that we do it, we have to grow our grain as well. So we have that full grain growing season. So 3 years, basically, before we can have a bottle on the market. But quite often it will be longer than that because the whiskey might need 3 to 4 years aging time. So it's a very long process and you've got to have a lot of patience.
And Ross is a sixth generation farmer. What has the rest of your family and your team thought of this kind of little side hustle that you've created?
Probably was a little bit sort of apprehensive to begin with. But as we've sort of built it and gotten into it, it seems to be starting out quite well, and everyone's involved. So Dad helps me with the malting. So we malt our own barley here as well. So he loves doing the malting. And, everyone sort of is pitching in a little bit here and there, wherever it's needed.
Ross Shaw, Gippsland agronomist and sixth-generation farmer. What a story, yeah. And if you want to read more about it, you can, abc.net.au/rural. It's a great one to have a look at as well. Thank you so much. It's been fun being with you on the Country Hour for the past couple of days. My name's Matt Stevens. I'm sure that we will catch up again. Big thanks to Brooke Neindorf and Elsie Adamo for putting the shows together, and they'll be with you tomorrow morning for your Rural Report at 6:15. Stay safe and enjoy the rest of your day. 1 o'clock news coming up.
Rushes in and bowls it. Yorker and bowls him.
ABC Sports Summer of Cricket on your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.